Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Hello. That's a nice way of saying settle down. Pay attention, right? I used to be a professor, too, so I have all those tricks up the sleeve. So, my name is Greg Kimura, and for folks who were there on the first day, the opening session, I am Yonsei. I'm the president and CEO of the museum, but I am also a fourth generation Alaskan. And until taking the job at the Japanese American National Museum, my daughter Lily was the fifth generation, and my son Julian the fifth generation of Japanese Alaskans. And I made the joke that we're all, that it was a small community, was all my family, but here we have examples of people who are not my family. So there are more than one family of Nikkei up there. I wanted to say a couple of words informally because I'm so pleased that this session is part of this national conference. One of the parts of the story of Japanese America we need to do a better job of is telling the story of Hawaii, Alaska, and some of the communities that are outside of the big centers of population because they have their own stories to tell. I want to make one little correction with a nod to Marla here. This is the Japanese Alaskan Aleut, and it should be said Pribilovian session as well. Those folks were removed and incarcerated as well. And I want to say a couple things out of school here too. I first met Ron sometime in the early 80s when I think you were probably still a PhD student or a graduate student of some variety at a Japanese restaurant in downtown. And this is how my memory is. It's escaped me what that restaurant downtown was, downtown Anchorage. It was a period of time before redress and was taking a look at the fact that all Alaska families went to the same assembly center and the same camp, Minidoka, and that this was different, say, from Seattle or Los Angeles or other areas of high concentration where their families were sometimes split up. This made for a very unique situation because there were about 100 families or so to file a class action lawsuit against the United States potentially for to in effect a redress like movement. Of course, it never progressed anywhere. But that's the first time I got to know Ron, and have been following him ever since. And of course, Ron was the curator of the permanent exhibit at the Museum of the North, the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I saw there's some flyers here from that that exhibit. A great debt of gratitude is owed to him for being really the historian and the keeper of permanent record of memory, not just for the community, but for every tourist who comes into the Museum of the North will see this important story. And this is kind of my thinking at the museum in L.A. as well. It's important for us to tell each other the story and to share it with future generations of Japanese Americans. It is perhaps even more important that we share this story to people outside the community who have no natural inclination to know anything about Japanese America or Aleut, Pribilovian America, but need to know the civil rights story to understand that our story as essentially an American story. I just turned 45, and so like my memory, short-term memory is going. But I have been waiting for a year to do something right now that I can't do because I forgot. Amongst the most important personal items that I have that I will never part with is a signed copy of the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians Commission Report, Personal Justice Denied. It was signed by Senator Ted Stevens personally to me because his wife, Catherine, was a classmate of one of my aunties and had traveled to D.C. a couple times with Close Up and Boys Nation, the opportunity. And, of course, my issue was always reparations, redress. But that signed copy has meant very much to me. But you know that there's also, along with that big book, there's a smaller Part 2 pamphlet which is the recommendations that talks about the three things: apology, the $20,000, and then evacuation of all the criminal convictions for, you know, breaking curfew and things like that. I don't know how it happened, but I have a copy of that, and it says, "If found, please return to Marie Nash." I might have had this for 20 years. And I was going, this was going to be that pregnant pause moment where I was going to hand that to you.
It must be yours by now.
I will send that to you. Marie, you know, being such a long-time employee of Senator Stevens, this is part of the story that needs to be told, too. You know, I say, even to people who are walking into the museum, there's this iconic photo of the president signing the reparations bill. And I said, look at the tall Hakajine in the back. Well, that wasn't Ted Stevens, because he was so short. That was Don Young. But there's an important part that Alaska played on the legislative level. And a lot of the stories that how these things move through Congress and everything are built on personal relationships and the stories of people who these politicians knew. And Marie, how many years did you work for the senator?
I worked almost 30 years. I'm 29 years.
Okay. As the scheduler, she was the gatekeeper. You didn't get to meet. You didn't get to see the senator without Marie, without such a close and personal relationship with the senator, and whose own story of being, whose father, Aleut, mother Aleut, and father Japanese. I think maybe the only, talk about tough times, right? Interned in different ways on both sides. Incredible story. Now, hopefully we're going to see portions of Aleut's story. In the early 90s, Alaska was one of the few places that didn't have a JACL chapter, and a number of us got together, and I signed up. You need 30 paying members to have a chapter of JACL. I think, this is no exaggeration, 18 of those original 30 members I got by getting members of my family to join. But part of the doing that is that the JACL Alaska chapter took on the responsibility of hosting the Day of Remembrance. And so one of the first days of remembrance we had at the Anchorage Museum, we showed Aleut's story, powerful story. We said, well, you know, so this day where we remember principally in Japanese America, Japanese American incarceration and that experience, important that we never forget the fact that the Pribilovians and the Aleuts went through a similar, parallel, in some ways harsher, different in many respects, but equally horrific camp experience. And I just met Bob, but he knows like all my family too. So I'm very pleased to finally meet you and to hear the stories. And I've taken up more than enough time. You're not here to hear me, but I wanted to kind of set a little. I'm just so pleased and proud to have this group here. And I'm going to be sitting in back. I'm going to be the guy smiling from ear to ear just to listen to everything that these folks have to share today. So thanks.
Thank you, Greg, for bringing recognition to really the role of Alaska in national life. We're such a small population. We're a big state, but no one knows about us. And this helps to bring our story to the stage. I wanted to open up by asking, who are we? How do we identify ourselves? And how do people identify us? Whenever you go to a formal session in Alaska with many Alaska Native people, if they are Athabascans or Tlingit people, they will not tell you who they are. They will say, I am of a particular clan. Then they will say, my grandmother is of this clan, my grandfather is of this clan on both sides. Then they will tell you who their parents are. And then they will tell you who they are, because they are part of something much larger, and they recognize that. When you look at the biographies in the program of each individual speaker, it starts with me, and we go out but you still don't know who they are. Well, in 1988, I came to a JACL meeting here in Seattle. It was a very interesting time because we were on campus. And I didn't know any of these people. I was from Alaska. So I stayed in the dorm, went down to have breakfast, and I sat down with this group of people, and I introduced myself. And they looked at me blankly, and the first question out of their mouths was, "Which camp were you in?" Then the second question was, "Who are your parents? Where did they come from?" And in 5 minutes, that table of 12 people knew more about me than I knew about my family. And I think that's interesting because we have our own idea of who we are and why we're important. But until you're nestled into the totality, you have no understanding of the other factors that are really very critical to knowing who you are. And that's what life is. As you get older, you find out where you fit in that larger web of things. And I think, in a sense, that's really what this whole effort of redress and remembrance is. It's seeking and coming to terms with things that we previously maybe didn't know, and in the process, hopefully sharing that with others. So our format is going to be to have each one of our panelists talk for about 15 minutes, and then we'll try to entertain questions at the very end. Well, I wanted to start out a little bit by talking a little bit about the history of Alaska. We know that there were Native peoples there for many, many years. And the Aleut people that we're going to be talking about and who Marla is going to be showing some clips were there at least 10,000 years ago. They have had a long story along the coast, along the Aleutian Islands and the Pribilof Islands. They were there in that position when World War II came. And they were at threat because the Japanese invaded the United States of America. They bombed us at Dutch Harbor. They took prisoners from the village of Attu, a teacher, and native people, and they took them to Japan as prisoners of war. How many of you knew that? They were taken away, and they were taken to the town of Otaru. And they were, as all prisoners of war are, they are put under surveillance. They had very bad living conditions, as did the Japanese. They had very little to eat, very little medical care, and about half of them died there. They came back, and they were very bitter. But they were the prisoners of war. And the U.S. government decided that they didn't want more Aleut people, more Alaskans, in that theater and possibly be taken as prisoners of war. So they removed the Aleut people from that long Aleutian Island chain and from the Pribilof Islands, and took them to southeast Alaska, where they would be out of harm's way. Unfortunately, they had no structure to do that. For the Japanese Americans, at least there were government agencies trying to build camps, delaying it in assembly centers so that they would have a place to settle them, and were commemorating them at Minidoka and at Poston and at other places. But in Alaska, it was poor school teachers who were told by the BIA, "You have 1,500 people coming, find a place for them." And it was tragic. They were taken to the Wrangell Institute, which was a school for Native children. From there, they were dispatched to canneries and to other very, very marginal housing because they had no infrastructure to do any of that. And the tragic system was that Japanese Alaskans were being evacuated out of Alaska to Puyallup, to Camp Harmony, and then largely to Minidoka. The Aleuts were taken from their homelands, from the Aleutian Chain and Pribilof Islands, and taken to southeast Alaska, where most of the Japanese were being evacuated from, and put into camps there for the duration of the war. Marla's film talks very eloquently about that period. And I think it's really interesting when you take a look back into the presence of Japanese in Alaska. The earliest recorded content that I could find was really looking at the period of the Russian America Company when Russia actually owned what is now Alaska, previous to 1867. And if you look in a geographic place names, it's called ORTH. It's a standard reference for all of us in the library world. It lists a place called Japonsky Island, right opposite Sitka. And all the Japanese tourists say, "Oh, look, there's Fuji, Alaska no Fuji." Well, that is called Japonsky because the Russians found some shipwrecked Japanese sailors during that early Russian-America period, and they said, oh, there are Japanese living there. It's Japonsky Island. So that would be before 1867 that those people were there. And it's really ironic that if you think about where the Japanese current goes, we know that it goes across the Pacific. One part of it goes up north, one part of it goes south. Well, the part that goes north is where all those Japanese came from. And during the Meiji period, when there was very prior to the Meiji, Japan was in a period of isolation, and their shipping technology was terrible because they weren't allowed to go out or to learn from foreigners. So they would put their fishing vessels out, and they would lumber along, and they would have shipwrecks. And there were lots of shipwrecked people. But they would be picked up by other people and taken to what is now known as Sitka. It was Old Archangel, New Archangel. And it was at one point the most prosperous commercial port on the west coast of North America. There was no San Francisco. There was no Los Angeles. The Russians were shipping furs to China. They were getting the furs in Alaska. And they were using that as a commercial network. So all of these commerce ships would pick up these wrecked Japanese in Alaska, go to Kamchatka, and eventually get them back into Japan. So there are long ties for Japanese to have been there, and we're only now beginning to recognize what some of those connections were. I wanted to talk a little bit about the other Japanese that we've been able to learn about. I come from Fairbanks, and Fairbanks is a relatively new town, primarily Caucasian people. There were never any native people who lived there previously. We have now a commission to have a statue, a piece of sculpture, that's going to be put into a new park because there were federal monies available for such a sculpture. And we're putting together some signage about early Fairbanks. We are so excited because we found a picture of Jujiro Wada in Fairbanks in 1909 going across the river. Wada was one of those guys who worked as a captain's boy on the revenue cutter Bear. Came from San Francisco all the way up into the Bering Sea patrolling for all of those cargo ships from Russia and other places. He was up there many, many years. He was well known all over the North as this Japanese musher because he was really quite an outdoorsman. But when the word came of the Fairbanks gold discovery, he was sent from Fairbanks into the Yukon to bring word of that gold rush into Alaska because everything was gone in the Klondike and they wanted all of those miners to come to Fairbanks where they could have another gold rush. So Wada was the one who went to the Yukon and told them about the Fairbanks gold rush. Well, it turns out later, if you look into the history books, the National Park Service has done a wonderful story about the Iditarod Trail. And you've heard about that, going all the way up into Nome with tales of gold discovery. Well, it turns out the Seward Commercial Company, much earlier, wanted to get all the miners to come to Seward rather than Valdez. So they hired Jujiro Wada to blaze a trail going from Seward, where the boats could come in. The gold seekers could then have a unified trail going all the way up into Nome. So you have this very curious Japanese man who sort of pops up in Alaska history, a marvelous musher, but one who also mushed into the Northwest Territories. And it's sort of ironic that now we're working with some of the Canadians to bring greater recognition to a person like that, someone who we like to say runs in and out of Canadian and Alaska history. And these are the first times we've actually been able to document that he was there. And that the Hakujing people will say, oh, there was someone who wasn't Caucasian who was there for the gold rush. So it's a process of discovery that's quite interesting. I wanted to mention, too, a little bit about some of the other people that we were able to interview through the process. And they included a large number of people who settled in southeast Alaska, which is where most of the Japanese were located. And when I first went to Ketchikan in 1970 to teach, I met Bob's parents. They ran a store in Ketchikan, and it was sort of the hub of the area right around the docks. A lot of Caucasian people, a lot of Alaska Native people. But it was wonderful to be there and to see what had evolved as a Japanese community and to see then the tail end of that period when there were less Japanese there. Because Bob, like a lot of his cohorts, raised in Alaska, go through the war, well-educated, there ain't a place for you in Alaska if you got a trade because we're so small. And so a lot of our people eventually left, and they disseminated all over the country. But Bob's family was one of the strongest ones. They ran businesses. There was a Japanese school there, very active in the community. They were deported, or should I say put into internment camps. And the first year that I was there, I am so grateful to the National Endowment for the Humanities because I applied for one of their so-called Young Scholars Grants. And I got $1,500, which was just amazing for me. And I was able to use that time to go through all the Southeast Alaska newspapers and look for stories about Japanese who were evacuated. And I got to compile that into a little document that became sort of the source for the rest of us that were curious about that period of history. And I continue to love the humanities because later on, when there was a task force to create the Alaska Humanities Forum, the statewide organization, I was appointed to the task force. And so it was wonderful to have that continuation of the ability to do things. So when they all say, too much government, I say, that may be right, but in the case of the arts and humanities, we are grateful, and we should support them. Continuing on a little bit, I would like to speak maybe about one or two other Japanese who were very interesting. Here in Seattle, you may have heard about Harry Kawabe, who was a very generous benefactor in the commercial community. He actually started out in Seward. He ran a lot of little businesses, but primarily a cleaners for all of the Alaska steamship boats that would offload passengers there. And he would take all of their commercial stuff and essentially process it, clean it, so that the Alaska Steamship Company would have fresh linen. He hired a lot of other Japanese to help him. But in the interim, he was always looking for ways to promote ties between Japan and Alaska. Alaska was a treasure trove of natural resources. Japan needed it. Harry worked his heart out trying to make that happen. But he was in Alaska, small communities, no recognition, really, for the fact that we had acres of trees, we had tons of fish. We had minerals, but no one would listen to him. Harry was interned, left Alaska, and when he got out of camp, he decided there was a better opportunity for him to take his case, being based in Seattle. So that's what he did. He had a very, very wonderful gift shop in what's now the Four Seasons Hotel, upscale because he wanted to show that Japanese products were good quality, that they weren't all cheap, made in Japan stuff. And he was a constant advocate for more Japanese-American trade. And he preached that for many, many years. Got into real estate, made a lot of money selling property, but always becoming an ambassador for U.S.-Japan trade using Alaska resources. When Harry died, he left a sizable endowment to the community here in Seattle, Japanese community. And if you go to the International District, there's a retirement building way at the top with a huge K on the building. It's by the Buddhist temple area. And that K is for Harry Kawabe because he gave back to this community in a way to perpetuate that long-term commitment and interest in Japanese-American relations. And I think Harry's contribution is recognized in Seward because he set up a scholarship that is now given to the top scholars in Seward High School. And it's a continuing legacy in Seward. And the community responded by having a park that's named for him. So if you go to Seward, go look for the Kawabe Park, and you will know the story of this very, very interesting man who was too early. He really saw the need for that bridge, but his idea was a little too early. But he lived out his dream by coming to Seattle at a time when there was more opportunity. And his story is legendary now. I want to tell one more story about a man whose name was Fuki Kaimori, that lady from the national park. is here. He was a photographer in the little town of Yakutat. He was a bachelor. He had a camera. You know those early Japanese photographers? Well, he was one of those. And he lived in Yakutat, was a watchman in the cannery. And he loved to take pictures of everything that went on in that town. Marriages, deaths, celebrations. His photographs are so well regarded that Frederica de Laguna, who was an anthropologist documenting the native people in that area, actually used his images. And you see them now in Smithsonian publications. Well, when word came that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, the community in Yakutat had a community meeting to see what to do. They were concerned about Mr. Kaimori because he had a camera. And some people thought he was a spy. And others thought, oh, how could this man who's been with us for so long be a spy? They went up to his cabin and they found that he was dead, committed suicide. And so there's been a lot of speculation about who he was and what his role was. Some people say he was a spy, others say not. But I think that's sort of the way we see ourselves, the way we identify, and the way other people see us. And we constantly live in that nexus of knowing who we are, how people see us, and what we think we know about ourselves. It's a journey we're all on. I'm going to have Maureen Nash now talk about another kind of identity, I think a very special one.
Thank you, Ron. I always appreciate his vast fountain of knowledge and that he can speak off the cuff of all of this information. I have to follow kind of a script because I know this whole program has been an emotional one for many of us, and if I don't follow my script, I might forget something. But before I even start, I would like to mention that I have some items set up in the table back there that I brought that are kind of remembrances of my dad and my family, and you're welcome to look at them. They're part of history, and anyway, I loaded them in a suitcase, and then I had to hand carry one because it wouldn't fit. So thank you for having this panel and for putting this program on, Dr. Kimura. It's nice to see you and your family again. I'm pleased to be joining Ron and Marla and Bob here to share our Alaskan experiences. While I was born in Minidoka, when my parents and older brother were there, I have no memories of being interned. I do remember growing up in my village of Egashik on the Alaska Peninsula and feeling strange as I grew up, and I think it was because villagers didn't know how to treat us after we returned from the war. Our home was occupied by someone else, as happened in other places across the United States, when personal property was not always kept for those who were evacuated. I remember my sister asking me, "Don't you think Mom feels funny when we visit people and she sees her dishes being used by someone else?" Before my family could leave Minidoka, though, my father had to request permission so that he and the family could return to Alaska. I was 2 years old at the time. After returning to Egashik, we lived in the small old house that at one time belonged to another family member and had a low ceiling and very low doorways. My father built a new house next to it, and some villagers were good enough to help out. We appreciated their help, and maybe in some ways that was their way to welcome us back. Over the years, my parents rarely discussed what happened to them, and it took a long time for me to gather information and learn more. My mother would occasionally say something about when she was in camp, such as such and such happened. And Ron and other folks in Fairbanks invited her and me up to make a presentation to the community and to a university class. And it was a very emotional time for both of us to talk about what happened. Ron, thank you again for inviting us to share our story back then. I remember how interested the students were and how they asked us lots of questions. My father and others from the Bristol Bay area were taken to Naknek, a little bit larger community, where they were jailed. My father met some others, such as Mark Hrotchka and Pete Hyanna there. They were from Dillingham, and maybe Bob knows them too or knew of them. When my mother and brother were left behind, people said things to my mother which scared her, and made her think that they could harm my little brother because of his heritage. So she asked to join my father. My mother is Alaska Native, and my father was born in Hawaii. In talking to Mark Hrotchka's son, he said comments were made by folks in his area that they were going to burn down the homes of Japanese Americans until a Caucasian man stood up and stopped them. While attending college in Spokane, I took a trip to Tacoma once to meet the Jinguji family, who had been interned with my family, and they kept in touch with my parents. Over the years, we've lost touch with them. My mother also told Sam Keto, whose family was from Petersburg, that my father babysat him at camp. My parents didn't talk about what happened to them. And it was in high school history class that our teacher talked about the Japanese being interned. And I would like to thank a lot of the teachers that are here that have talked about this in their studies and in their classes. After that, I made an effort to learn as much as I could, although my biggest regret was not talking directly to my parents about their personal experiences. My father joined the Army and was sent to Camp Shelby for training. He was part of the 442nd and served overseas. While there, he was wounded and received the Purple Heart as well as a Bronze Star Medal. And as I said, I brought some of his medals and his books and other items that I thought might be of interest. When I went to Washington, D.C. to work for Senator Stevens, the National Archives had an exhibit on Executive Order 9066, so I made sure to go check out that exhibit. Later, when I was back in Alaska and working for Governor Hammond, the Alaska legislature was considering legislation that affected Aleut people who were interned in southeastern Alaska, as Ron mentioned. Because the Japanese invaded the Aleutian Islands, Aleuts were moved to southeastern, and Marla did a wonderful story on how they were affected. And sometimes it's still shown on TV and anchors, so I really appreciate that they continue to show that. At the time, Greg Brelsford was working for the Aleutian Purple Love Islands Association, which was also involved in the legislation, and he asked for my help and support because of my Aleut heritage on my mother's side and because of my internment in Idaho. When I went back to Washington, D.C. to work a second time for Senator Stevens, legislation was prepared and hearings were held, which resulted in the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians report, Personal Justice Denied. I have one of the original copies here, and I noticed they do have copies out there at that one bookstall of reprints. Senator Stevens knew of my personal experience along with my family, so he was good about keeping me involved and keeping me informed. The first person voices of Japanese American incarceration yesterday made a powerful impact on many of us, and I'm glad others found their voices to be able to share their personal experiences. After I was back in Alaska when the legislation was passed and then President Reagan was going to sign it into law, Senator Stevens invited me and several Aleut people to be there for the signing. Several of us flew all night to be there for that significant occasion. Was anybody else here able to attend? Well, you probably don't know then. At first, the signing was to be in the Rose Garden at the White House, but we were told that the gardeners had spread fertilizer in the garden. And since it was so hot in August, the ceremony was moved to the Interior Department Auditorium. We Alaskans were grateful not to be outside in the heat and humidity. When we entered the auditorium, I was very surprised at the number of people in attendance. Our small group of Alaskans sat in the back, and I tried to take pictures, but we were too far away. It was still an honor to be there, to see President Reagan, Senator Stevens, Senator Inouye, Congressman Young, Congressman Netta, and others who had been involved in passing the legislation up on the stage. To this day, we are grateful for those who stood up for us in getting this legislation passed. The letter of apology given to us was an important part in continuing to heal and deal with how we were treated. After the signing ceremony, Senator Stevens invited us Alaskans to join him for lunch in the Senate dining room of the U.S. Capitol. A photograph was taken of us with him, and that photo is a memento of that important day. That picture and a reprint of H.R. 442 are hanging at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks, thanks to Ron and others. And a copy of that picture and the H.R. 442 are in the back on the table. And then when the Congressional Gold Medal was awarded to the Japanese Americans who served in World War II, the National Veterans Association held a gathering in Washington, and I was honored to attend as a representative of my family on behalf of my father. While there is only one gold medal, friends and supporters were kind enough to make a duplicate for each family who attended the event. And as you know, the gold medal is making a tour of the United States so others can view it, and I hope it makes its way to Alaska. And that way, many people will be able to learn about its history and about our heroes who served our country. I want to also mention that yesterday, when we toured the Wing Luke Asian Museum, we visited the Seattle Nisei Veterans Committee Memorial Hall, which has a wonderful tribute to our veterans. A replica of that gold medal is also on display there. In closing, I would like to thank all our veterans for their service and also recognize the families for their support. We in Alaska are fortunate to have the strong support and leadership of Senator Stevens, who has given special recognition from the Japanese American Citizens League Legislative Education Committee. And I'm pleased to say that he gave me his award before he passed away, and that's back on the table as well. We have lost many of our World War II veterans of Japanese heritage, but we recognize and honor them today. We have lost other Alaskans, such as Father Paul Merkulev, Mary Nikolai Bordakovsky, and Barbara Sweetman Smith, who helped the Aleut people in this effort. I know you worked with many of them, Marla, in your effort to get out the Aleut story. Again, thank you very much for hosting us today. I appreciate being a part of this important event. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Bob Ohashi, and I'm from Ketchikan, Alaska, a town that I never thought I'd ever leave, even during the evacuation. But anyway, my grandfather was the first one to be going to Alaska, and he went up close to the turn of the century to find gold, but unfortunately he got stuck in Ketchikan, and he started a restaurant there. There may be a picture of it, but I grew up in a community in Ketchikan called Indian Town, and it's about a block away from the dock where all the ships dock. And the Native Americans and I were really very close friends. They're my best friends. But when we were young, in fact, when I was 5 years old, I was actually baptized in the St. Elizabeth Episcopalian Church, which was a Native American church. And I don't know if there's a certificate there.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. That's my grandfather and his family. My mom and dad are up in the upper right. And my two aunts are on the left. But by the time I was, let me say this one thing first. We didn't know that the Aleuts were evacuated to the Ketchikan area for one. They were there when we were being evacuated south. But anyway, my childhood memories up there are just... Sorry. We had so much fun, but it was all good, clean fun in those days. You don't realize that nowadays. We used to go swimming from early spring in Ketchikan, and that was awfully cold. We used to go about a mile up in the hills to this place called Beaver Dam. And since it was just boys only, you know how we were swimming. Yeah. But after we'd swim, we'd make a bonfire and roast potatoes. But when I got to be about 12 years old, I got my first job in Ketchikan, and I was working for Tatsuda's grocery store. They used to take about 2 hours off for lunch, which was nice. It was their whole family, and they'd leave the store, and I'd be watching the store, and I'd make 50 cents an hour, which was great, you know, in those days. And then when I was 14, there was a really big salmon run in Alaska. It's probably one of the biggest they ever had because we were recruited at 14 years of age to go work at Waterfall Cannery, which is one of the newest, most modern canneries in Alaska. And there was just so much fish. And in 2 weeks' time, even in those days, I made $200. I don't know where that went, but yeah. But the crew that came up to Waterfall in those days were Nisei from Seattle. And this was where they got their money to go to college, which was nice, you know. So anyway, about a year before the war started, I happened to look through some papers that we had at home and noticed that the Japanese community in Ketchikan had donated a bunch of cherry trees to the park. This was a year before the war. So it was quite interesting. She may be able to get it up there. Yeah. But anyway, when the war started, they took all the husbands and interned them at Annette Island, which was about 16 miles from Ketchikan, and left the wives to fend for themselves with their children at home, you know, and that was very difficult. But I used to help this one, Mrs. Hagiwara. They had a really nice bakery, and she couldn't bake anymore because the husband was a baker. And I used to have to go around. There was three or four other bakeries in town, and I used to have to go around and collect things for her to sell in her place, yeah. But after the husbands were interned, well, we got a notice to get ready to leave Alaska. And the funny thing was, I don't know how my mother did it, but we had the only washing machine in camp. Big washing machine, imagine that. Yeah, but coming down from Ketchikan, where the people from Southeast Alaska had assembled, there weren't that many, but Juneau, Sitka, Wrangell, Petersburg, we all left Ketchikan on the ship, and at that time, our husbands were released to come with us, plus three sons who were going into the service at the same time. Very ironic. So anyway, three of the boys were, two were in the 442, and one was in MIS service, and I know Pat and Jimmy were both wounded over there. But we got to Puyallup, not realizing that here we're getting ready to head for Puyallup, Washington, but the husbands didn't get to come with us. They went to Lordsburg, New Mexico, and the three sons were going into the service. But in Puyallup, I think we were the first ones, the Alaskans, you know. And we were the first one there, so we had the farthest barracks from everything. And I think the Seattleites were very curious, gee, I wonder what those Alaskan savages are like. But, you know, really, once they, you know, sort of assimilated with us, it got to be really nice, and we got along very well. But then we went to Minidoka, which was, oh, sort of different. Very wet, not wet, but dusty. And I have to relate one story about Pilip. The barracks between the partitions were only about 6 feet tall, and you can hear what was going on from one end to the other, you know. And one evening, I don't know what happened, but my brother happened to climb over the wall in his sleep. He fell into the other room. A room full of women. Well, of course, he was only about 10 years old. I think Minidoka, for a lot of the young people, was not that bad of an experience because we had sports, we had school, we had many dances. And I don't know, it got to be real personal with a lot of people. And I still have many of them that are friends, and some were from the same block as me, but we still are friends in Seattle here. The one big reason a lot of the friendships have remained is because of the, well, I'll say the name, Bob Sato. Because Bob was a guy that could really convince you to do something, you know. So he convinced me to join the Blaine Church, which I did, which I'm still in now. And a lot of my good friends are all there. And we also have a golf group from the church that plays once a month, couples group. Yeah. But anyway, after the war, we went to, my dad was released from Lordsburg, New Mexico in 44, just before the war was over. And we stayed there for about a month, and he really enjoyed it because he was a warehouse watchman. And he got to eat all this nice, fresh fruit, you know. But the thing I always think about when we were in the camp, you know, we got to go out to the farms and help pick fruit and potatoes and whatever. And I think really if we hadn't gone there, they might have had a disastrous year in the farming community there. But also while I was in camp, I went out to Chicago for 2 months to work at the National Tea Company. It's a big warehouse for wholesale food. And it's fine, but I stayed there for 2 months with my friend, and I decided to come back to camp. Coming back to camp was on this train, and it was just full of GIs. I was the one guy in this compartment with all the GIs in there, and then there was one lady that came that had a husband in in Idaho, in one of the service areas, and she sits next to me. It's just, I was really edgy, but nothing happened, you know. Yeah. Then when my friend's mother saw me in camp after I returned, she started crying. I was so thin. But anyway, we went back to Alaska with the family, and the first person to welcome us back was Sam Daniels, the police chief. Yeah. You know, the town, actually, I never ever heard the J word or anything, even after the war, you know. Oh, that's my dear honey over there. Yeah. Came back from the camp, and I got drafted in the Army in 1946 and was shipped overseas to Okinawa, where I was in the MP unit. And we guarded Japanese prisoners of war. And an ironic thing, we had one kamikaze pilot, you know. What's he doing alive? Yeah, it's very. And I can't speak a lot of Japanese. My folks can, and they spoke English very well. But the soldiers told me that, you know, when the war got in the later stages in Okinawa, their ammunition was gone. And it got cold at night in these caves that they used to stay in, and they used to break up their rifles to keep warm. Yeah. So anyway, I was in Okinawa for about a year. I really enjoyed the people over there. Coming back on the ship, you know, after I was going to be released for the service, I was walking up the gangplank, and all of a sudden I hear, "Whoosh!" I look up there, it's my friend from camp. So we had a good time talking. Yeah. But coming back home, I really realized I had to do something. So I went to the UW, started pharmacy school, and well, that's where we met Marion. And sometimes you get lucky. But anyway, we went around for a couple of years, and we really had a very good courtship. But that's one thing when you're in college and you have a girlfriend or boyfriend, you got to be careful of your studies. You really do, because I was put on probation in pharmacy school. Marion used to work for the athletic director of the University of Washington, Harvey Castle. And I stayed at a place called Sinkoa. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it was a Japanese student residence that was about a block off the campus. And there might be a picture of that. Anyway, after getting out of pharmacy school, it was very difficult to find work, you know, because we were the first Nisei after the war, and there was a lot of prejudice out there. But after a couple of years of working around at several different stores, I got this wonderful opportunity on Beacon Hill in Seattle to work for Owens Pharmacy. And from the start, I had a half day's overtime every week, and it was union pay. And then on Christmas, I got a bonus, which is very unusual. But that just shows to me that if you work hard, and the Nisei did, that were our first bunch getting out of the war, the people will notice it. And that's why I think a lot of the kids nowadays have had this lot of opportunities, you know, just to follow the lead of their parents. But anyway, the thing that clinched it for Marion and me, we were at a picnic. I love this story. We are entered in a three-legged race. And guess who won? Yeah, but we were married and had four children, lived on Beacon Hill for 60 years now. Yeah, in the same house. But it's sort of ironic because when we came in there, we were the youngest couple that was in the neighborhood. Now we're the oldest. Yeah. But the same house, wonderful place. Oh, I'll have to tell you a couple stories about my pharmacy.
One more story.
I'm ready. Yeah. The one story occurred when I was back there filling prescriptions, and all of a sudden I happened to turn sideways, and here's this guy standing there with a gun. And the first thing I noticed about the gun, it had this tube on extension there. I said, that's a silencer, to myself, you know. So I told him, I'm not going to do anything, so why don't you put your gun away? And there was that happened to be a girl, my clerk, working in front, but she didn't even see him come back. And so he says to me, I don't want your money, I want your drugs. So I said, okay. It surprised me that I was pretty calm, you know, under the situation. And I went back and filled up of this bag full of stuff. But he didn't realize I filled it with laxatives. Really. But he never did come back. Yeah. A lot of funny stories, but I guess I should call it quits. That's enough.
Marla, would you like to take the...
Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay.
Hi. First of all, thank you very much for your patience. I'm sorry for all of the skittering around that we were doing. I found that television and related technology never works when you need it to, sort of like our missile interceptors. So we have it. Ron did have a beautiful PowerPoint presentation that maybe we'll have to call a forum out front and I can show you that later. I'm sorry you missed it. I was asked the genesis of my involvement with the issue of the Aleut American or the Onongan internment began when I was asked to produce a short corporate film, about a 15, 20-minute piece, on the restoration of some Russian Orthodox churches. And I thought, okay, it's fine. You know, in between documentaries, it helps pay bills. And so I really believe that the answer, when I asked questions about why are these churches important, it was going to go to the architectural value of these buildings. Instead, what I found is that these churches had been seriously damaged during World War II, and that not only that, that the homes of the people who worshiped there had been seriously damaged, and it had been by U.S. forces, and that the money being used to restore these churches was coming in part from a federal restitution trust fund. And so I said, now, what is this fund? I don't know about this fund. How come federal money is being used on a church, you know? And they said, oh, yeah, well, you know, a lot of our people, they were, you know, forced to evacuate and put in these terrible camps, and about 10% of us died there. And well, we have a bigger story here, folks. Let's tell the bigger story. And so we began the work. It took us 5 years. As Marie said, people had not spoken of their experiences for a very long time. It was, as I'm sure many of you can relate, for a variety of reasons, it was painful, and for some it felt shameful. And for others, their children just simply didn't believe them when they did talk about it. So it became my honor and my privilege to spend a lot of time with folks in the Aleutians and the Pribilof Islands to revisit the camps where people were taken, and to produce a film which is called Aleut Story. It premiered in 2005, and I'm happy to say that our syndication with PBS continues through 2015. We will have 10 years of being on the air. And Mary Wojtkowski, who passed away recently, she's such a sweet woman. She said, Marla, you need to do one thing for me, one thing only. I want this to go into the history books. And we now have an exhibit as part of the Library of Congress and the National Archives. And we are in major institutions, teaching institutions around the country, and even in 6th and 7th and 8th grade classrooms, which is really quite fun, too. We also have a website, which is under redevelopment. There are some cards at the back for you to get more information. Rather than have me talk so much, I thought what I might do, fingers crossed, everyone, is show you a few clips. I'll show you the open from the documentary and then two other clips so that you can hear the voices of those who actually lived the experience far better than me.
They kicked us all up. Then they burned the churches, burned the buildings. It was terrible. American citizens were starving, were dying.
The story was never told. It was purposely held secret.
What happened here on our own continent is a tragedy. If this was known, the American people would be appalled.
The Aleut were not seen as a national security threat. The underlying motivation for their forced evacuation and then their confinement was racism. And tragically, what I think is just simply greed. The largest source of revenue in 1942 to the U.S. Treasury was from the sale of fur seal pelts. And the Aleut were expert, having been enslaved by the Russians 200 years prior, to harvest fur seals. In June of 42, after the evacuation began, they tried to use U.S. Army soldiers to harvest fur seals, and they did an abysmal job. The government actually lost money. And so they said, well, that's not going to work. So the Aleut men, whether they were at the camps or whether they had joined the service, were rounded back up, taken back to the islands at a time of active war, and used to harvest fur seals. And so the primary motivation was there was not respect for them as individuals because there was an atmosphere of racism. And frankly, the government wanted to ensure continued income to the Treasury during a time of war. So different motivations, but, you know, you end up in kind of miserable conditions as well. Do we have time for one more clip, or are we done? Ron, are we out of time?
Sure. We've got 1 minute left.
Well...
The unceasing toll of disease and death was recorded in official camp logs.
Thursday, July 8th. St. George evacuation camp. Every man except the cook, the priest, and I had the flu. Monday, July 12th. Still having the flu. Friday, July 16th, about 5 a.m., Alexandra, the wife of Isidore Nesterov, died. One man helped build a casket. Two men dug a grave.
My mom had a little Sergei, baby Sergei, we call it. And he was 3 months old when he got double pneumonia. And there was the government nurse there sent him back home with my mom, saying nothing they could do for him. So my mom took him to the midwives. She told him to keep him warm, but where we lived, they only had a 55-gallon drum to warm up something like a 40 by 80 canary. My mom and the midwives tried their best to get him healthy, but they couldn't, and he just cried, and he died in my mom's arms, you know. And they went and got the priest came over and gave a blessing to the child, and the next day the carpenters were down at the shop making a little coffin for him, and then those were the hardest childhood days we had.
I want to thank all of you for coming today. I hope that you've learned something about Alaska. I hope that you'll keep that in your heads and you'll think about us. In the back are some things to be distributed. One is a handout from the Aleut Japanese Museum display. And a second is for a project in Juneau called the Empty Chair that is currently going on. The Tanaka family ran the ferry cafe for a number of years, and they were evacuated. Johnny Tanaka was a valedictorian of Juneau High School. He was not allowed to graduate because he had to evacuate. So they had a special ceremony just for him and his family. They gave him his diploma. At the formal graduation at Juneau High School, they had an empty chair on the stage for Johnny. Johnny has since passed away, but his sister, Mary Abo, and a group of people in Juneau are commemorating that event, and they're erecting a bronze empty chair that's going to be on a pedestal in a Juneau park. And if you'd like to learn more about it, there's a brochure on the back. So in these ways, I guess we all remember what happened. And for some, it's a bronze chair on a pedestal. For some, it's a wonderful film. For others, it's our stories. But pass it on. No one else will. Thank you.